This morning I'd like you to turn, if you would, to Acts chapter 20. That's our passage this morning. In our study in the book of Acts so far, we have seen Paul the Apostle become a Christian. That was Acts chapter 9. And from there, our God used Paul greatly in ministry. Paul, after becoming a believer and spending some time in the area of Jerusalem and out in a desert, he ended up in ministry in Syria and Cyprus and Asia Minor, Macedonia and Greece. I mean, Paul made the rounds to major regions and major continents as he followed what the Lord wanted him to do as he preached Christ to other people. What's really amazing is that he did this on two or three journeys, and we typically refer to those journeys as the first or second or third missionary journey. And it was during those missionary journeys that he had an opportunity to tell others about who Jesus Christ was. He did not visit every area three times. Some places it was only two. Generally speaking, he visited them at least twice, and sometimes he visited them on three different occasions. During the last three studies that we've been involved in, it's the latter part of the third missionary journey, and Paul was in Ephesus, if you recall. In fact, the first Sunday, the first study that we were looking at, Paul had an opportunity to help 12 disciples of John the Baptist, find their Messiah, find Jesus Christ. In our second study in the city of Ephesus, Paul was being used in mighty ways. If you recall, dirty, sweaty rags were taken from Paul and was placed on people so that they got well, and also that demons were expelled. And we saw some really interesting things occur where some Jewish priests tried to mimic what Paul was doing, and they got beat up for it because the demons didn't recognize them. They recognized Paul, they recognized Jesus, but they did not recognize these Jewish exorcists. They just had it all wrong. And in our last study, which was last week, we saw Paul and some of his friends, Gaius and Artichicus. They ended up almost in a riot. In fact, actually, Gaius and Artichicus were probably right at the base of a theater in Ephesus, and the riot was about ready to break out on them, and God brought a town clerk along to rescue them, in fact, actually to quell and put down the whole riot. Because he was a leader in the city, he was a Roman representative, and he had the opportunity, he had the rule, he had the authority, and he did that. He told everyone to go home, and he disbanded the problem. That has been Paul's journey so far since he became a Christian. Well, this morning we are in Acts chapter 20, and we are in verse 1. Actually, we ended our study last week in verse 1, but we will pick it up again this morning, just as a transition point. Acts chapter 20, verse 1 says, "And after the uproar," that is after the riot, "had ceased, Paul sent to the disciples, and when he had exhorted them and taken his leave of them, he left to go to Macedonia." Here, very quickly, we're told that the riot had stopped. We're told that Paul called for the disciples of Ephesus, and he spent some time with them. We're going to find out in a little bit that Paul is in a farewell mode. Paul recognizes that he will not return, and we'll find that out here in just a second. So I assume that what Paul has done is he's called these disciples of Ephesus together so that he can encourage them, he can say his final farewells, and they can move on. Well, it turns out at the very end of the verse it says that he left to go to Macedonia. But if we look at Acts chapter 19, verse 21, what we'll find is that this trip is not unplanned. This trip is not something that he just decided to do, that this trip is something that he has been planning for some time. Acts chapter 19, 21 says, "Now after these things were finished, Paul purposed in the spirit to go to Jerusalem after he had passed through Macedonia and Achaia." Achaia would be part of what we might refer to as Greece. So what we're told here in verse 21 is that Paul knew that he was going from Macedonia to Achaia. He knew that there was a trip to take. That's what he was planning to do. And we'll get into the chart here in a little bit, okay? But bottom line, the important piece at this point is to understand that Paul knew that he was going to Macedonia. Paul knew that he was going to Achaia. And when verse 1, when we're told that he goes to Macedonia, this is not something that Paul has just decided to do because there were problems in Ephesus. Okay? Paul has been planning this for some time. You say, well, why was Paul planning that? Look at Acts chapter 20. Look ahead and look at verse 22. Verse 22 says, "And now, behold, bound by the Spirit, I'm on my way to Jerusalem, not knowing what will happen to me there, except that the Holy Spirit solemnly testifies to me in every city, saying that bonds and afflictions await me." Paul is going to Macedonia because the Holy Spirit has told Paul that is what he wants him to do. The Holy Spirit had already told Paul that he was to go to Macedonia, and then he's to go to Achaia, and after that, what he's supposed to do is then go to Jerusalem. That is the game plan. And you say, well, how do you know that this is Paul's final journey? Well, look at the very end of the chapter, verse 38. And it says, "Grieving especially over the word which he had spoken to them." That is, Paul had spoken it to the Ephesian elders, as we'll find out later on, "that they would not see his face again, and they were accompanying him to the ship." What verse 38 tells us is that Paul knew that his final visit with Ephesus, his final time with the Ephesian elders, this was the end. He would never come back. Paul is on his way to Jerusalem, and for those of us who know Paul's life, what he will end up doing once he returns to Jerusalem is he'll end up in a pack of trouble. And from there, he takes a trip to Rome, and the whole intent there on the part, at least the Jews who caused this to happen, their goal was Paul's death. This is the last time that Paul will ever be in Ephesus. And the journey through Macedonia and Achaia is a farewell tour, as we're going to find out. This is a farewell tour. It is Paul's last opportunity to express his love and his passion for these people in Macedonia and Achaia. You know, what's interesting is that Paul is not just a leader. Paul is not just an apostle. Paul is not just a teacher. Paul is someone who happens to love the people to whom he is ministering. Paul has a passion for people. Now look at Philippians chapter 1, verse 7. In Philippians chapter 1, what we'll find is that Paul loved the folks who were in Philippi. This is the letter to the Philippians, and Paul wrote it. And in verse 7, Paul writes, he says, "For it is only right for me to feel this way about you, because I have you in my heart, since both in my imprisonment and in the defense and confirmation of the gospel, you are all partakers of grace with me." Now watch verse 8. "For God is my witness how I long for you all." You know what the folks in Philippi were? They weren't just an object of ministry. The folks in Philippi weren't just people that he taught. They weren't just people who supported him in ministry or worked alongside him. The people in Philippi were people who Paul loved, he longed for, he cared for. There's another city in Macedonia, and it's called Thessalonica. Look at 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 8, Paul writes to them, he says, "having so fond an affection for you." Paul just didn't have some kind of an abstract love for them. He uses a very emotional word, and it's the word affection. He says, "I have a fond affection for you." Paul loved these people. Or how about 2 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 3. 2 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 3, he says, "I do not speak to condemn you, for I have said before that you are in our hearts." Great verse. Paul had the Corinthians who caused him a ton of trouble. If you recall, 1 Corinthians is an ongoing rebuke of the Corinthians, and 2 Corinthians is a rebuke of them as well. And in 2 Corinthians, what's even amazing is that they were uncertain about Paul's apostleship. And Paul had to remind them that he was an apostle. And he had to defend himself. And yet, Paul talks about them being in his heart. Watch this. Paul loved the people who were in Macedonia, and he loved the people who were in Achaia. Paul suffered for them, he sacrificed for them, and he gave himself for them. And yet, what's interesting is that Paul, He continued in ministry even when some people even defected from him. If you recall, John Mark in Acts 13:13 left him. In 2 Corinthians chapter 7, I won't turn there, but verses 5 to 6, Paul makes the point that he was depressed over them. And isn't that amazing? Here is a pastor, if you please. Here is an apostle. Here is a teacher. And he is depressed over the people because of the way in which they responded to what he had to say. Later in his ministry, he would write that Demas deserted him because he loved the world. Paul had some huge disappointments in ministry. But yet Paul loved the folks who were in Macedonia. I mean, they weren't just objects of ministry. They weren't just objects of love. They were people that he had a real passion for. He had emotion for. You can probably think about people in your own life that you think about their name and you have emotion for them. You have a passion for them. Well, Paul, he had a passion for the people that he ministered to. And so he leaves Ephesus. To the best we can figure out, he probably left Ephesus in March or April of AD 55. It's about a year and a half journey through Macedonia and Achaia, is the best we can figure out. In 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 12 to 13, I won't turn there right now, but I'll invite you to turn there on your own if you'd like. What you'll find out is that Paul actually, before he made it to Macedonia, he stopped through Troas. And so if we could have our map back, what you'll find is that Paul, he made his way from Ephesus. He went all the way up to Troas, and then he leapfrogged over into Macedonia and then worked his way down into Achaia. He went through Philippi, who were people that he loved, and Thessalonica. We've already talked about those folks. We have no similar statement about Berea, but I can't imagine that Paul didn't love them as well. And then all the way down into Athens and down into Corinth. Today, this is all we see of the ruins in Troas. Now, there's columns everywhere. Next chart. Here is a bathhouse. They just didn't have a bathtub. They had a bathhouse, and it was a magnificent bathhouse at that. You can see the ocean or the sea, the Aegean Sea in the background. Next chart. This is Philippi with the Acropolis on top of a hill. Next chart. Here's another shot of Philippi looking down on the Forum. You can see other parts of the ruins. Philippi was an incredible place. Another chart. This is Athens with the Acropolis. Paul was in Athens, you remember, when he spoke on Mars Hill? Incredible things Paul saw. Incredible opportunities for ministry that Paul had. Next chart. This is in Corinth. Looking across over to the sea. Next chart. And this is what we often refer to as the Corinthian Column. Great place. Great place that Paul was at. Paul made his way down through Macedonia, down into Achaia. And all through this time, he was preaching Jesus Christ. And he was, I believe, saying his final farewells. Verse 2. Acts 20, verse 2. When he had gone through those districts and had given them much exhortation, he came to Greece. Verse 3, and there he spent 3 months, and when a plot was formed against him by the Jews, as he was about to set sail for Syria, he decided to return through Macedonia. Now, verse 3 tells us that Paul spent 3 months there in Greece, or Achaia. He spent 3 months with the people. I imagine he taught. I imagine that he shared Christ. I imagine that he prayed with them. I imagine that he cried with them. And I imagine that he said farewell to them because it was the last time he'd see these people. People who were dear to his heart. Then we're told that there was a plot. I mean, what else is new? I mean, everywhere Paul goes just about, someone is upset with Paul. Somebody wants to kill Paul. So Paul finds another discouragement in the ministry in verse 3. And here's a plot against him. And it says, as he was about to set sail for Syria. Syria is just north of Palestine. So it means that just about the time that he was ready to get on a boat at Kenchrea, which would have been a little bit more to the east of Corinth, and allowed him then to get access to a boat so he could actually make the trip all the way over to Syria. What he found is that there was a plot, and apparently the plot must have hindered him from getting to the seaport, okay? And so he decided to go back through Achaia and go back up through Macedonia. I think we have another slide, I think it is, yeah. So this would just show the return trip that he would have going from Corinth back through Athens all the way up to Philippi, because our passage says that he wanted to go back up through Macedonia, okay? Verse 4, and he was accompanied by Sopater of Berea, the son of Pyrrhus, and by Aristarchus and Secundus of the Thessalonians, and Gaius and of Derbe, and Timothy and Tychicus and Trophimus of Asia. So there were some men who were with Paul. We don't know a whole lot about these men, but all we really know about these men is what's given to us here in verse 4. We're told that Sopater was a Berea. We're told that Tychicus and Secundus were from Thessalonica. It's interesting that these men were traveling with Paul. Thessalonica is part of Macedonia, right? Gaius was from Derbe. Now, it's interesting that Derbe is actually out of Galatia. Sopater was out of Berea, which was just a little bit south of Thessalonica. And we're told in Acts 16:1 that Timothy was from Lystra, which was actually also part of Asia Minor. And we're told in Acts 21:28, we'll get there a little bit later, we'll find out that Trophimus was actually from Ephesus. So what Paul has is Paul has an entourage of men, co-laborers, fellow laborers, fellow workers who are traveling with Paul. The next thing we know about these men is the first part of verse 4 says, and he was accompanied. The Greek word for accompanied is in the imperfect, and it has the idea that these men were, they were constantly traveling with Paul. So Paul, when he traveled, he just didn't travel by himself. Paul had a group of men who traveled with him. And where Paul went, they went, for the most part. But what we find out here in this particular case is in verse 5, it says, but these had gone on ahead and were waiting for us at Troas. So these co-laborers, they went on ahead. Apparently they went on to Cenchrea, they caught the boat, and it went all the way up to Troas. But Paul, he didn't do that. He went back through the path that he had traveled all the way up to Philippi. And it's interesting that in verse 5 we find it says, but these had gone on ahead and were waiting for us. It's been a while since we've heard that word. Look at verse 6. And we, it's been a while since we heard that. The writer is all of a sudden present. The writer of Acts, who is Luke, Dr. Luke, all of a sudden he shows up again. We suspect that Dr. Luke was probably in Corinth or in Athens, somewhere down in Greece, and Paul has reconnected with Dr. Luke, and Dr. Luke now is traveling one more time with Paul, and so they go and they take the trip and they move all the way up to Philippi, as the map shows. Verse 6 tells us that we sailed from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread and came to them at Troas within 5 days, and there we stayed 7 days. He says that we were there until after the days of the unleavened bread. The days of unleavened bread would have been from 7 to 14 April of AD 57. That's a year and a half later. When it tells us that they left, it would have been on the 14th of April of AD 57. And then he says it took them 5 days to navigate the waters. Today, guess what? Today, if you were to take a boat from Philippi over to Troas, it's a 55-minute ride in a boat. Back in Paul's time, it took 5 days. But today, you could do it in 55 minutes. Not too bad today. But back then, when you had to depend on the winds and the currents and all that, it took them 5 days to make the trip. By the time they got to Troas, it was now April 19, AD 57. So now Paul and the men, they are back together. Verse 7. And on the first day of the week, we gathered together to break bread, and Paul began talking to them, intending to leave the next day, and he prolonged his message until midnight. Verse 7 tells us that it was the first day of the week. Interestingly enough, this is probably the strongest passage in the New Testament, indicating to us that the early church met on Sunday, not on a Sabbath day. We're also told, if you look closely, it says that they gathered to break bread. This would have been the agape meal. What they did is that they ate the meal first, and then they did communion at the end, okay? And that's basically what happened. What we'll also find out is that apparently the worship service started in the evening hours. It says at the end of 7, as he prolonged his message until midnight. More than likely, it was either late afternoon or it was in the evening that they held their church service, not in the morning. Now, I'd like to go back before I leave this verse, though, and talk about the fact that they met on the first day of the week. chart, please. If you look at the commandments in the Old Testament, and you look at the commandments in the New Testament, the Ten Commandments are repeated in the New Testament, all of them except for one. The one that's not repeated is the one that deals with the Sabbath. You get all the rest of them, but to remember the Sabbath, it doesn't appear anywhere in the New Testament. Now, if we're supposed to, as Christians, celebrate the Lord's death, if we're to gather together, and we're supposed to do it on a Sabbath day, isn't it interesting that the command's not repeated in the New Testament? Isn't it also interesting that in all of Paul's letters to all the Gentiles, that nowhere ever does he ever tell anybody to worship on a Sabbath? In fact, in Colossians chapter 2, verses 16 to 17, I won't turn there, but if you were to turn there, you would find out that Paul, in fact, tells the folks in Colossae that the Sabbath is a shadow of Christ. I mean, it's a shadow. It's not the real thing. It's not the important thing. It's a shadow of Christ. Those are probably the three strongest reasons why we celebrate on Sunday, why we gather together on Sunday as Christians. We have four strong reasons here in the book of Acts, chapter 20, verse 7, the commandments, Colossians chapter 2, and then the fact that the just total absence of any kind of instruction on Paul's part or any other apostle's part in the New Testament commanding us to do otherwise. So these believers, they gathered on the first day of the week on a Sunday. They gathered together for the agape meal, and then Paul started preaching, and he prolonged his message until midnight, verse 8. And there were many lamps in the upper room where they were gathered together. When it says many lamps, I'm thinking to myself, there are probably many lamps because there were a lot of people. There were a lot of people and they needed some light. And Paul is talking and he's talking and he's talking. In fact, actually, the Greek word for lamps is not lamps, it's torches. And we know what a torch is. A torch that has flames and there are fumes that are going out. And if you have a lot of torches in an upper room with a lot of people, what happens after a while? Gets a little stuffy, doesn't it? Okay, look at the next verse. Verse 9, and there was a young man named Eutychus, sitting on the windowsill, sinking into a deep sleep. The Greek word actually has the idea that he was getting deeper and deeper and deeper into the sleep. He was having more and more difficulty staying awake. Over the years, I've found it interesting as I have had opportunity to teach or opportunities to preach, and every once in a while you find someone sitting there and they're going, and you know exactly what's going on. Eventually, they're just going to go, and they're going to be that way for a while. They're going to have their heads hanging down. Not too long ago, someone in the Bible study on Sunday night, I could see that their eyes were real big, and I knew what was going on. And they're looking at me, and after a while, their eyes just went shut. They just couldn't hang on to it. But after people eat something, they have a hard time staying awake. Well, this poor guy is in a room that's stuffy. There are a lot of people. There are torches. There's smoke, and I can just imagine this young guy had a real problem. Now you say, well, young guy, yeah, look at verse 12 for a minute. Let's jump ahead for a second. It says, and they took away the boy alive. The word for boy here is paideia in the Greek, and it means that he's roughly somewhere between 7 to 14 years of age. So this is a young guy, and the rest of verse 12 says, and they were greatly comforted, and we'll find out why in a second. So here's a young guy. He's 7 to 14 years old. Apparently, he wants to go and sit in the window, probably because it's getting a little stuffy, and maybe even mom or dad told him to go do it. But unfortunately, he falls asleep, and Paul just kept on talking. And he was finally overcome by sleep, and he fell down from the third floor and was picked up dead. Somebody picked him up and declared him to be dead. As I was thinking about the story, I couldn't help but think about myself. As I was a 7 or 8 year old, my mother tells me about the story. And I remember some pieces about it. I don't remember the whole thing. We were planning to move from one city to another, and my mother tells me that for the longest time, I kept wanting to get up on the roof of this house and jump off of the roof down to the ground. It was a house where the landlord lived on top, and there was a stairway you could walk up to get to the landlord's place. There was a railing, and you could step across a railing onto the rooftop. And apparently what I had done in the past is I had stepped over that railing onto the roof, and my mom had to tell me to go back down. Well, My mother tells me that she thinks I saw this as my last opportunity to jump off the roof. It was the last day, the moving van was there and they were loading it. And so what does John do? He climbs up the stairs, he steps over this rail, he goes over to the side of the roof, and I jump down to the ground, all the way down from the roof. I remember going down and then my leg hurting me. That's what I remember. And my mother came running out, and because I'm crying at this point and I'm having pain in my leg, obviously, and my mother is relieved that my leg's not broken. I don't know how it happened, but this poor young guy, he fell down from 3 floors, and he's dead, verse 10. But Paul went down, and he fell on him, and after embracing him, he said, "Do not be troubled, for his life is in him." Some people have said, well, this means that he really wasn't dead. No, what Paul is trying to tell them is that his life's been restored. It's interesting that Elijah, in 1 Kings chapter 17, verse 21, he did the same thing Paul did. Elisha, in 2 Kings chapter 4, verse 34, he did the same thing. Both of them laid on someone and they came back to life. Paul did the same thing. Verse 11, "And when he had gone back up and had broken the bread and eaten, he talked with them a long while until daybreak and then left." I was thinking, first thing most people probably react to is, wow, why didn't Paul cut it short? No, the interesting thing is, why did the people hang around? Now, the reason they hung around and why the reason Paul hung on was because it was farewells. Final instructions and farewells. This is departure time. This is a love relationship. Paul had spent 3 years of ministry with these people, and the bond was there. And this is departure time. "And they took away the boy alive and were greatly comforted. But we," verse 13, "going ahead to the ship and set sail for Assos, intending from there to take Paul on board, for so he had arranged it, intending himself to go by land. And when he had met us at Assos, we took him on board and came to Mytilene." Well, apparently what happens is that Paul can't make it to the fishing boat or the sailboat or whatever the ship was in time, so they go on ahead, and Paul makes a trek over land. Next chart. So what we see here on the map up here on the screen is that he moves from Troas, he swings by Assos, then he swings down past some islands. We've already talked about Mytilene, there'll be Chios, Samos, and then finally he'll get to Miletus. He bypasses Ephesus, as you'll see. Okay, so let's read the next verse, verse 15. "And sailing from there, we arrived the following day opposite Chios, and the next day we crossed over to Samos, and the day following we came to Miletus." So what Luke does is he just describes the journey. He describes the journey all the way down to Miletus. Verse 16, "For Paul had decided to sail past Ephesus so that he would not have to spend time in Asia, for he was hurrying to be in Jerusalem, if possible, on the day of Pentecost." Paul's in a hurry. He wants now to get to Jerusalem as fast as he can. He's already said his farewells in Ephesus, so he chooses not to stop by and do it again. And so he's trying to rush. So he moves on. He gets to Miletus. We'll see next week that what he does is he calls for the elders from Ephesus to come and meet him in Miletus. So that's Paul's journey. That's Paul's farewell journey. Paul, he gave everything he had for God. Paul was not just an apostle. Paul was not just a teacher. He wasn't just a leader. He wasn't just a bondservant. He wasn't just any of these things. Paul wasn't an apostle. He wasn't a teacher. He wasn't a leader. He wasn't a bondservant. You know what Paul was? Paul was a friend. Paul was a friend. Think about 1 Corinthians 13. Corinthians 13, 1. It says, "If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and do not have love, I have become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal." You know what Paul told the Corinthians here? He says, look, he says, I can have spiritual gifts. I can do all kinds of ministry for the Lord. I mean, I can be an apostle. I can be a leader. I can be a disciple maker. I can be this. I can be that. I can do all kinds of things. If I don't have love, I'm nothing more than a noisy gong and a clanging cymbal. You know what Paul was? Paul wasn't just an apostle. Paul wasn't just a disciple maker. Paul wasn't just a leader. And Paul wasn't a clanging cymbal, and he wasn't a noisy gong. Paul was one who ministered and he cared for people. Paul loved people. Paul cared about people. Paul sacrificed himself and he gave of his body, he gave of his heart, he gave everything that he had. This morning you might be saying to yourself, well, you know, that's okay for Paul. Paul was Paul, you know, Paul was an apostle. God doesn't expect me to do this kind of stuff. Oh, really? Look with me. Would you turn to Luke chapter 9? Luke 9, 23. Jesus has just gotten through talking with the disciples about Elijah, John the Baptist. He has had an interesting conversation with them. Then in verse 23, we're told here in the passage, and he was saying to them, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. Now, I want you to notice that there are four important steps in this passage. There are four important steps, and it's written to disciples. It's written to us. It's written to all of us. It actually says to all. That's a key word. Saying to all. Saying to all of his disciples. Saying to all of them. And notice what he says. He must first deny himself. Now, I was thinking about what does the word deny mean? Some of us, when we think about self-denial, we think about denying ourselves some food. We think about denying ourselves maybe some chocolate, or we think about denying ourselves TV, or we think about denying ourselves some want or some desire. That's not the kind of denial that Jesus is talking about here. The Greek word for deny means to disown or to renounce. It has the idea of renouncing yourself. It has the idea that you're not denying yourself something, you're renouncing yourself, not something else. It's you that you denounce. It's you that you deny. It's you that you disown. It's the idea that you disown yourself. Not that you're denying yourself some food or you're denying yourself this or that. It's the idea that you denounce yourself. That is the idea. And then notice what Jesus says next. He says, and take up his cross daily. Some people have a weird idea about what it means to take up your cross. Some people said, well, I have this cross to bear this week. I've got this cross, you know, this cross, it just hangs on. It's just something I work through, I labor through for the Lord. That's not the kind of cross Jesus was talking about. Everybody in that day knew what a cross was. The bar, whether it was an upright or whether it was a cross piece like we've got it, everybody knew what a cross was, what a Roman cross was, where the hands were put up and they were either tied or nailed, and the feet were tied or nailed, and the spear was put through your side to motivate your death. A cross was a symbol of death. That's what it was. It was an indication that you were ready to die. And so when Jesus says you have to renounce yourself, you have to disown yourself and take up your cross every day, what Jesus was trying to tell them is that you must be ready to die for me. And somebody says, well, I'm not really ready to do that. Then I guess you didn't disown yourself yet, did you? You didn't renounce yourself yet, did you? You didn't get the first point. The first point is you disown yourself, you renounce yourself. And then if you've really done that, then you are ready to take up his cross. You're really ready to die for him. That's Jesus' point. And notice what Jesus says, and then you can follow me. If you've denounced yourself and you're really willing to die, then you can follow me. You're not ready to follow me until you've gone through those first two steps. But you know what really is probably the key piece in this whole verse? I said there are four parts to it, right? We've gone through one, two, three. There's one left. Did you notice what the last one is? Look at the beginning of the verse. It says, if anyone wishes to come after me. I would imagine that most of us in here say that we're Christians. We're followers of Jesus, right? Can I ask you a question? Do you think you're a follower of Jesus this morning? If you answered yes, you think you're a follower of Jesus, then guess what it says here? If anyone wishes to follow me, you must renounce yourself, be willing to die, and then you are really a follower of me. Notice what it says. If anyone wishes. Can I ask you this morning, do you wish to follow Jesus? Is the wishing there? Well, for Paul, the wishing was there. And Paul renounced, he denounced, he disowned himself. And Paul was willing to die. And if we believe it correctly, the letters that he wrote to the Corinthians indicates that Paul did die. Paul was a follower of Jesus. And you say, well, yeah, I can't accomplish very much for God. Can I make a very important comment this morning, if that's the way you're thinking about it? You can't accomplish very much? Jesus doesn't really care whether or not you accomplish very much. He just wants you to stone yourself, be ready to die for him. Whether or not you accomplish much for him or not, that's his business, not yours. He just wants to know that you're ready to follow. Whether it's a little bit or a whole bunch, whether you become significant or insignificant, that doesn't really matter. The issue is, are you ready to follow? That's the issue. Jesus really doesn't care whether or not you think you're going to get some significant benefit out of following Jesus or not. First thing he wants is he wants you. And that starts by you disowning yourself. Paul did that. Paul did that. He sacrificed himself for all these people. And in the process of doing all that, he fell in love with them. And what we've just seen this morning is Paul's final farewell of a man who sacrificed himself in every way for Jesus Christ. He's our example. We shouldn't view him as the exception. We should view him as the pattern. Let's pray.